The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodkey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the September-October 2023 issue. We begin with our story, Sherlock of Sleep. Part scientist, part detective, Michael Kramer Borneman has devoted his life to understanding and explaining parasomnias, including some of the most mysterious and deadliest sleep disorders ever studied. The elderly man woke up one night to find himself in a bed soaked with blood. His wife, lying next to him, was dead, stabbed with a letter opener. The man was charged with murder, though he claimed to have no memory of what had happened. The defense attorney was stumped because there was no plausible motive for his client to have killed his wife. The couple had been together for decades, and everything suggested a harmonious, loving relationship with no signs of strife, nor were there mitigating factors like alcohol or drug intoxication. Was it possible, the attorney wondered, that his client had been asleep when his wife was killed, and thus was unaware of what he might have done? While many might deem a scenario like that preposterous, it's the kind of question Michael Kramer Borneman addresses almost every day. Looking into cases like this, for him, is a full-time job with one goal, to educate a jury on whether there is consciousness and therefore criminal intent when a sleep-related incident occurs. It's a job for which Kramer Borneman is uniquely qualified. He is the lead investigator for Sleep Forensics Associates, or SFA, a St. Paul, Minnesota-based company founded to provide valid scientific information in criminal cases involving parasomnias, abnormal, unwanted, and unintentional behaviors that can occur during sleep. Kramer Borneman started the firm in 2006 with two internationally known authorities on sleep disorders, neurologist Mark Mahewald and psychiatrist Carlos Schenck, both professors at the University of Minnesota Medical School. Mahewald died in March 2020. SFA was initially part of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorder Center, where Mahewald was director and Kramer Borneman co-director. Although Kramer Borneman confers regularly with Schenck and other experts, SFA is now a one-man operation. To date, he's consulted on more than 400 parasomnia cases, and the work has taken him throughout the U.S. and Canada, as well as to Germany, Israel, Japan, and New Zealand. The demand for Kramer Borneman and SFA's unique expertise is due in large part to a simple fact. The division between sleep and wakefulness is not always clear. Consciousness is not a binary on-off phenomenon, Kramer Borneman insists. It occurs on a spectrum, he says. When sleep and wake states get mixed up, strange and sometimes violent circumstances can arise. Another motivation for starting SFA, Schenck explains, was to help ensure that qualified scientists with decades of valid sleep research are the ones providing expert testimony in court. The firm, he adds, represents clients without any bias towards the defense or prosecution. Until SFA has reviewed the available evidence of any case, they won't guarantee which side their assessments will ultimately favor. In a world where a wily culprit might be tempted to claim a sleepwalking defense to escape a conviction, Kramer Borneman's insight can make a crucial difference in serving justice. SFA has helped bring credibility to the task of differentiating between genuine parasomnias and deliberate criminal acts, says Alon Avedon, director of the UCLA Sleep Disorder Center. Cleet Kushida, director of the Stanford University Center for Human Sleep Research, agrees, calling the founders of SFA well-established sleep researchers who have all written key articles on parasomnias and their forensic implications. Kushida does believe that the so-called sleepwalking defense is legitimate in some cases. Almost anything you can do while you are awake, it is possible to do while you are asleep, he says. Sleepwalking, or somnambulism, one of the most common and widely known types of parasomnias, occurs during the non-rapid eye movement or non-REM phase of sleep. It's a multifaceted phenomenon where people may not merely walk in their sleep, but could also consume vast quantities of food or perform otherwise strange and outrageous acts, such as relieving themselves in a bedroom closet or dresser drawer. In some cases, sleepers can even get into their cars and drive while still technically slumbering. Far less common are parasomnias during REM, or so-called dream sleep. REM sleep occurs about once every 90 minutes, lasting 10 to 15 minutes. During that time, the body is usually paralyzed, which serves as a protective mechanism. But in the 1980s, Mahewald and Schenck discovered what they called REM sleep behavior disorder, or RBD, a condition that enables people to act out unpleasant or combative dreams, or at least attempt to do so. Individuals with RBD are not fully immobilized during REM sleep and can thus thrash, kick, punch, or much worse. Schenck first documented this condition in a clinical setting in September 1982, when he joined the staff of the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorder Center. On his very first day, he met with a 67-year-old patient, Donald Dorf, who complained about his moving nightmares. Dorf related a football dream he had in which he had smashed into a 280-pound lineman. In reality, he had crashed into his bedroom dresser, shattering a mirror and knocking everything off the top. Dorf eventually spent a night at the sleep lab, where he was observed jerking and kicking his limbs during REM sleep. "I was the first scientist to see someone who could act out his dream," Schenck recalls. After accumulating several cases like this, Mahewald and Schenck published a landmark 1986 paper that introduced RBD to the scientific world. Through subsequent research, they concluded that the temporary lifting of paralysis during REM sleep was usually caused by neurologic degeneration. 90% of these patients, who were mostly older men, would go on to develop Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia. Dorf was among the lucky 10% who eluded those syndromes. Kramer-Bornemann's first foray into the field occurred in 1998, when he began research at the Sleep Center, then run by Mahewald. Kramer-Bornemann had earned his medical degree a few years earlier. He had decided to become a doctor in the hopes of earning respect, he says, something he had not received growing up as a half-Dutch refugee from Indonesia who came to the U.S. in 1969 at the age of 8. The discrimination he continually faced propelled him to become the best student possible, even as he pushed himself to excel in any sport and job he undertook. When Kramer-Bornemann first arrived at the sleep lab, his specialty was in pulmonary medicine. Working alongside Mahewald, he discovered that the earliest signs of respiratory distress associated with Lou Gehrig's disease show up during REM sleep. After that research was completed, Mahewald remarked, "You really enjoy working on sleep. How about another year or two of training?" Kramer-Bornemann has been studying sleep disorders ever since. In subsequent research, Kramer-Bornemann, Mahewald, and Schenck showed that parasomnias often arise during the transition from non-REM to REM sleep, as well as during shifts from wakefulness to non-REM sleep and from non-REM sleep to dream sleep. During these abrupt alterations in brain activity, switching errors can occur when something goes awry among the brain's network of 100 billion neurons, and an aberrant electrical signal is set off. If someone is startled during an episode like this, he or she may have instinctual primal responses, defensive, predatory, or even sexual in nature, that could be triggered because the prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for inhibiting such impulses, is offline, in sleep mode, so to speak. On rare occasions, the consequences can be deadly, especially if an object that could serve as a weapon is within reach. After several years at the center, Kramer-Bornemann couldn't ignore how often he and his colleagues were fielding calls from attorneys or law enforcement officials asking for advice on bizarre sleep-related cases. As Kramer Borneman saw it, providing their medical expertise would fulfill a civic duty. Mahewald and Schenck agreed, especially after Kramer Borneman persuaded them that income from forensic cases could help support the group's studies of other sleep disorders. What's more, he maintained, consulting work could provide access to many more cases of exotic nocturnal behaviors than they might typically encounter at the center. Establishing a new specialty in sleep forensics was also important, Kramer Borneman notes, because even though some clinicians are willing to speak up in court, they may have no idea of the legal process. To secure a conviction, you need to establish both actus reus, the guilty act, and mens rea, the guilty mind. He says, in the cases Kramer Borneman consults on, the act itself normally is not in doubt. The accused party may have already admitted to assaulting someone, or touching them inappropriately, or even committing murder, but they may claim no memory of doing so. It's the goal of sleep forensics, then, to determine the degree of consciousness. We need to provide a comment on mens rea in order to assess culpability, he says. Mahewald and Schenck were happy to evaluate cases, but had no interest in going to court. Kramer Borneman, on the other hand, relished the prospect. He had majored in philosophy in college and loved debating. He found that he enjoyed the challenge of explaining neuroscience in a way that lawyers, and especially juries, could understand. Kramer Borneman's medical training, clinical expertise, and growing knowledge of case law would eventually give him a unique set of qualifications for his job. Nobody else in the world is so dedicated, has been involved in so many cases, and has so much expertise, says Francesca Ingravallo, a medical legal expert at the University of Bologna in Italy. When a legal case involving sleep-related behavior arises, Michael's name is usually the first that comes up, as adds Susan Elizabeth Reese, an attorney based in Newport, Oregon, who has teamed up with Kramer Borneman in the past. In 2019, SFA's founders published a review of sleep-related violence, an analysis of the 351 referrals that they had investigated up to that point. A key message of this study, Schenck says, is that a variety of sleep disorders can lead to violence, including murder and sexual assault, or sexomnia. The SFA team, Ingravallo says, has acquired a huge statistical base compared to other groups in this field, one that affords a great opportunity to learn. We're not just providing a service to educate lawyers in the courts, Kramer Borneman says. By capturing all these cases and analyzing all the data, we are furthering our own understanding of these rare and strange parasomnias. For the most part, Kramer Borneman says, sleep medicine practitioners like himself are not starting with a grand theory. Learning comes by watching what people do and eventually finding patterns in their actions. A distinction is commonly drawn between so-called hard science and soft science, he says. Chemistry is considered a hard science. If you mix compound A with compound B and then heat that mixture to X degrees, you can quantify the results. But a lot of medicine isn't hard science. A lot of it is based on more of an observational approach. There's no blood test for schizophrenia, for example. Instead, over the years, enough people were seen who shared common features and behaviors, suggesting that they might have a similar disorder. And if enough people are studied over enough years, researchers may be able to predict what is likely to happen. That's what Kramer Borneman and his SFA colleagues are attempting to do, uncover secrets of the nocturnal realm by observing populations of people, one patient at a time. As to the case of the elderly man charged with his wife's murder, Kramer Borneman's investigation concluded that the client had altered mental status at the time of the incident. His unintended actions, in this case, were not the result of a parasomnia, but were more likely due to a neurological event that arose out of sleep, a seizure that could also have caused switching errors during non-REM sleep. We think parasomnias and seizures have a lot in common, Kramer Borneman says. Both are electrical circuit problems. In the end, the man avoided further prosecution. The decision was just, says Kramer Borneman, since in his assessment, the man clearly did not intend to kill his wife, and the punishment had already been meted out, Kramer Borneman adds. He had to live with this for the rest of his life. However, in another case, Kramer Borneman was hired to defend a different man accused of killing his wife. The defendant had previously been treated at the Minnesota Center and was actually observed experiencing a non-REM parasomnia. Despite this fact, the man's behavior wasn't consistent with parasomnia-related violence. Among other details, the man had followed his wife from room to room, stalking his prey, and changed his mind about what weapon to use before striking. This behavior pointed to a more deliberate conscious strategy than a spontaneous burst of violence more typical of a true parasomnia. In this case, the sleepwalking defense didn't hold, and the husband was convicted. About a third of the cases Kramer Barneman takes on are for the prosecution, though sometimes he takes on pro bono work. For instance, a distraught mother once contacted him shortly after her 19-year-old son had been run over by a tractor trailer at 2 a.m. just outside his home, dressed only in underwear and a t-shirt. Although the coroner concluded the death was a suicide, Kramer Barneman learned that the son had a history of sleepwalking and was able to have the ruling amended. That offered some relief to the grieving family. While such work is rewarding, Kramer Borneman's motivations transcend a desire to help others, to see justice done, or even to ascertain the full range of parasomnias. He's hoping to shed light on the workings of the brain itself. There are times, normally of brief duration, when people can simultaneously be both conscious and unconscious, a fact that courts have been slow to appreciate, adhering instead to the notion that an individual is either conscious or not. In most instances, the overlap between these two states is inconsequential and goes without notice. But occasionally, the outcome can be perplexing, and in some situations, a person can end up hurt or even dead. The scores of cases investigated by SFA have made one thing abundantly clear to Kramer Barneman. We have less control over our behaviors than we think, he says. And when the behavior gets really bizarre, I usually get a call. Parasomnia activity. Although many of the cases that Barneman and sleep forensics associates review tend to focus on violent parasomnias, this group of sleep disorders includes a wide range of unwanted and unintentional behaviors. They can occur in the transition to sleep, during sleep, or while waking up. It's estimated that as many as 10% of Americans suffer regularly from some form of parasomnia, although research suggests that more than half of all sleepers have had at least one parasomnia event, often as children. Here are two of the most common types. Sleepwalking, or somnambulism, is the most widely known type of parasomnia, occurring during the non-rapid eye movement, or non-REM, phase of sleep, and can include a lot more activities than walking. Eating excessively, going to the bathroom in inappropriate places, and even driving are all types of somnambulism. By the way, it's a myth that you should never wake a sleepwalker. You definitely should if they are doing something dangerous or could hurt themselves. But the best approach is to simply try to lead them back to bed. Bedwetting, or sleep or nocturnal enuresis, or involuntary urination while sleeping, is another common issue, especially in children, and it's happened to most everyone at some point in their lives. Although inconvenient and embarrassing, it's nothing to be ashamed of, and in most cases, it's a normal part of human development. To qualify as a true parasomnia, incidents of bedwetting generally would occur at least twice a week in people aged 5 or older, according to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Saving the World with Bill Nye. The beloved science educator reflects on his newest series, the success of NASA's DART mission, and how he stays optimistic about fighting climate change. Just minutes into his latest 6-part docuseries, The End is Nigh, Bill Nye gets drenched in a rainstorm. Later on, a hurricane sends him hurtling into a car's windshield. In a subsequent episode, he explodes in a fiery inferno after being struck by debris from a wayward comet. Don't worry, Nye, the science educator and engineer who became a household name in the 90s, thanks to his much-loved Bill Nye the Science Guy show, meets his fictional demise in every single episode. In a recent interview with Discover, Nye explains the apocalyptic framing behind his biggest budget series yet. We need to scare people. The series, released on Peacock in 2022, walks viewers through 6 scientifically plausible mass disasters, from the eruption of a supervolcano to a global blackout triggered by a coronal mass ejection in which electrically charged particles from the sun would create a magnetic field that shuts off power across the planet. Nye acts as a tour guide and human crash test dummy for each scenario, demonstrating how planet-demolishing disasters like killer earthquakes, desiccating dust storms, and record-shattering hurricanes would play out. The show was filmed on a soundstage in Montreal with Nye in front of a green screen for much of production. This allowed showrunners to later add eye-popping digital effects that demonstrate what it might look like to, say, dodge debris from an asteroid. I think the CGI makes the disaster seem more plausible, says Nye, who points to a moment in the show's second episode when he tries to outrace an avalanche of ash and smoke in the wake of a volcanic blast. When you see the volcanic pyroclastic death cloud sweep through Bozeman, Montana, and then me in a car, I think that's pretty compelling. Still, it's not all doom and gloom. Each episode follows up a world-ending calamity with science-backed solutions, some of which focus on curbing the effects of climate change. Nye describes how he teamed up with Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane and producer Brannon Braga, known for his work on Star Trek and sci-fi series The Orville, to show what disasters look like in real life and how to stop them. In the show, the perennially bow-tie-clad Nye doesn't play coy about the program's disaster movie roots. In one episode, he references the 1998 blockbuster Armageddon. Still, the series cuts through this spectacle by splicing together CGI simulations with scenes from real-life disasters. In one episode, a clip shows the destruction wrought by the 1964 Alaskan earthquake, which Nye remembers from his childhood. "I was in third grade," he says. "Alaska was this remote thing. It had just become a state. And we had that footage, real footage from this guy who was a longshoreman who was on the deck of a ship. And we were able to expand it and make it look cool and exciting." Some parts of The End Is Nigh skew closer to reality than you might think. When talking about how we might divert an asteroid on a collision course with Earth, Nye describes a promising solution on the horizon at the time, NASA's Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART, in which the agency planned to smash a golf cart-sized spacecraft into an asteroid to alter its trajectory. "Now we have proof of the mission's success. NASA reported that the DART spacecraft was, in fact, able to shift the space rock's orbit in late 2022. In early 2023, five studies published in Nature revealed the craft's final moments, as well as the aftermath of its collision." "People weren't sure that it was going to work," says Nye, who notes that he was at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Maryland, the mission's command center, to witness the historic moment. "The asteroid was so far away, and you couldn't direct the spacecraft by radio communication. The time for the radio signal to get there was too long. The thing had to drive itself. It had to be autonomous." "And it did. It ran right into it," adds Nye, who serves as CEO for the Planetary Society, an organization that promotes space exploration. "In other words, if humanity ever does find a hunk of space debris headed straight for us, we may well be able to prevent the unthinkable from happening." "Just don't send Bruce Willis," adds Nye. "It's not the way to do it. You have to do something more complicated and subtle." Nye has come a long way from donning a white lab coat to teach 90s kids about the buoyancy of objects or different phases of matter. In recent years, he's become a vocal advocate for combating climate change. See, for example, his 2017 Netflix series, Bill Nye Saves the World, in which he breaks down the science of global warming and tackles topics like climate change denial. So it's perhaps no surprise that The End Is Nigh sees its star once again beating the drum of climate change catastrophe. In an early episode, Nye lays out the scientific plausibility for hurricanes more destructive than anything we've seen before, thanks to our ever-warming oceans. Later on, he sketches out solutions that could help us alleviate or prevent that possibility, like using wind turbines as a buffer for storms, or harnessing carbon capture technology to pull carbon dioxide out of the air. Throughout the series, Nye's optimism about mitigating human-caused climate change is on full display. "You have to be optimistic or you're not going to get anything done," he says. "And the other thing that makes me very optimistic is young people are not going to keep acting like this. As young people dominate the electorate, They're going to vote for leaders who are going to make changes, and we are going to change the world. Nye also points to another global conflict that humanity overcame as a reason to remain hopeful, describing how both of his parents were veterans of World War II. My mom was recruited by the Navy to work on code breaking. She was a cryptanalyst, he says. My father spent 4 years as a prisoner of war. And I mention this because, at the time, everybody was fighting the war. Every farmer, every electrician, every truck driver, every scientist. Everybody was working to resolve this global conflict. Come on, people, adds Nye. We're the United States. Let's lead the world and get this done. Do insects have feelings and consciousness? A growing body of research is making some surprising discoveries about insects. Honeybees have emotional ups and downs. Bumblebees play with toys. Cockroaches have personalities, recognize their relatives, and team up to make decisions. Fruit flies experience something very like what we might call fear. Insects having emotions is not a new idea. In 1872, Charles Darwin wrote, "Even insects express anger, terror, jealousy, and love. If insects have fun with toys or flee in fear when you brandish the fly swatter, and if those expressions of anger, terror, jealousy, and love reflect something on the inside, then it's possible that insects have emotions, sentience, or even consciousness. Drop that fly swatter right now." We don't know what's on the inside, at least not yet. But neuroscientists and philosophers are beginning to take the idea of insect consciousness seriously. In an article published last year in Science, primatologist Franz de Waal and philosophy professor Kristen Andrews point out that science generally distinguishes between emotions and feelings. Emotions, they write, are measurable physiological and or neural states that are often reflected in behavior. That frantic buzzing when you mess with a bee, for example. Feelings, on the other hand, are private conscious states that are not publicly observable and hence are inaccessible to science. We're pretty sure other humans have feelings because they can tell us they do. Non-human animals can't. Was the bee buzzing in rage? Fear? We can't know because the bee can't tell us. However, animals aren't the only creatures who can't tell us what's happening inside. Human infants are silent on the matter as well. As de Waal and Andrews point out, it was only in the 1980s that doctors came to believe human babies felt pain. Prior to that, surgery on infants was routinely done with no anesthesia. In recent years, humans have gradually offered membership in the Sentience Club, not only to their own young, but to some other animals as well. In the last decade, many countries have begun to ban experimentation on all great apes. The U.S. ended research on chimpanzees in 2015. And the UK government recently recognized lobsters, crabs, and octopuses as sentience. But with insects, the question remains open. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.